They sat around the table, and the informant sat next to his sponsor. The sponsor cut the informant's finger with a knife to let the blood flow freely, and the significance was that the outfit was more important than his life. After this, his sponsor placed into the informant's cupped hands a picture of a saint, such as the type used as bookmarks in prayer books, and set it on fire. The informant had to hold this until it burned to ashes. The significance of this action was that the outfit must take precedence over God.
The legends of America's mobs are woven into the fabric of society and pop culture. We've all seen the movies or heard the tales of these criminal organizations. Their stories of power, wealth, respect, family, greed, betrayal, violence, murder, and mayhem. While the golden age of the mobs may be over, organized crime continues to thrive, and the stories remain as infamous as ever. You're listening to the Gangland History Podcast, hosted by mob historian Jacob Stoops. He tells the true crime biographies of real-life mobsters and dives deep into the plots, subplots, and real facts behind organized crime in America. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Gangland History Podcast. I am your host, Jacob Stoops, mafia historian, researcher, podcaster, lover of mob movies. We have another great show today, and although it's not going to be a what I'll just term a standard show in the sense of a biography, as many of my recent shows haven't been, today we're going to go back to basics a little bit. And why would we be going back to basics, you might ask? Well, in the process of doing research for my episodes, sometimes I just come across content that is really too good not to share. And I came across a whopper of a report. And this is one of those cases where I feel like it deserves an episode in its own right. It's really great stuff. And in this episode, speaking of that report, I will be deep diving on a fairly comprehensive 1967 FBI field report on the overall state of the mafia in the United States in around 1966 and 1967, which details the organization's history, existence, initiation rights, rules and regulations, and much more. It's a beast of a report. And I've, as I got to reading the report in the course of doing research for something completely different, I couldn't help but think, wow, this particular report would make a great piece of content. It would make a great episode series. And again, like I said, sometimes as a podcaster, as somebody who's looking to create content, you're not just looking at reports and doing research. You're thinking in the context of, what do my listeners want to hear? Is this something worth making an episode out of? And I can promise you that, at least to me, this particular report was. A lot of good stuff in it. Now, I know early on in the existence of the show, I did a basics of series, but a lot has changed. I've changed. My research style has changed. The format of the show has changed. And I do think that I can do a bit of a better job. And in this case, you're going to be hearing reports directly from members of the mob, as well as the FBI agents who were on the ground interviewing these members, developing informants, and putting this material together in the 1960s in almost every city that had a major mob presence. So pretty cool stuff. My hope is that you won't find it boring. My hope is that you'll appreciate the content. But if it is a bore, I totally understand. Some of it will be old information, right? You've probably heard it before if you've been in this genre for any length of time. But I can promise you that there will be some little tidbits that might surprise you, some myth-shattering things. Now, my hope is to get back to doing biographies in the near future. But the delay there has been that I've been collecting and amassing a lot of paperwork, and well, I just have to admit that all of my Freedom of Information Act requests are, or many of them, I should say, are still in process, and unfortunately, that process takes, in some cases, many, many weeks to get information back, and there's sometimes a little bit of back and forth involved for those that just aren't familiar with, well, how would you go about that? And sometimes what you do get back isn't very good, it's not enough, or You have to do some additional back and forth to say, all right, thanks for getting me this, but I'm really looking for this. Can you send it? And all of these things take additional time. And as I'm sure you can imagine, the government can move pretty slowly. So I have, I don't even know how many, probably 100 Freedom of Information Act requests in process right now. And what I will say, and this is a bit of a personal anecdote, you should see how many letters I get from the FBI, the Department of Justice, for all of the requests that I submit as part of the research for this podcast. The first time that my wife saw a letter from the FBI, I think she had a bit of a heart attack, maybe a heart palpitation. And I had to assure her, no, honey, well, here it is. This is why we're getting it. And no, I'm not getting arrested. At least I don't think so. but alas, that's the life of a historian and researcher trying to dig in on information. And all I can say is I can only imagine what the person that delivers the mail to my house must think. Anyhow, before we get to that, I've got a few quick things. I know some of my listeners hate my preambles, so bear with me for just a second. First off, we finally hit 10,000 subscribers. We moved from that four-digit number to the five-digit number, and I'm so thankful. Like, you can't even imagine. So thankful for all of the listeners who have helped me reach the goal and who take time out of your day to interact with me and my content. I started this podcast a couple of years ago, and while I realize I'm not the biggest podcast out there, I'm not the biggest name, I'm still a relative unknown, I've got a now not so small group of really like rabid, passionate followers, and I appreciate each and every one of you. It kind of keeps me grinding. It keeps me enjoying what I do, and I would love to make this my main hustle, but it allows me to make a little bit of money on the side, which I do appreciate. It's not what I'm doing it for, but I do appreciate it. And I just wanted to let everybody know how much I appreciate you and how much I enjoy interacting with your comments, good, bad, or ugly. If you're not already a subscriber, please help me continue to, you know, increase my followership, increase my audience by hitting that subscribe button, turning on the bell to get notifications, doing all the things, share the show, help me grow. As a token of my appreciation, I wanted to extend the offer that the first five people that send an email to ganglandhistorypodcast@gmail.com, I'd like to send you some free Gangland History Podcast swag. So I do have a merchandise store, and I would like to send you some swag. Now, second, before we get onto the show, I just wanted to say thank you to my capo level Patreon members, Brady Poirier, hopefully I got your name pronunciation correct, Puppet Master, Mr. Kuznarski. Those are the three capos in my family so far. Your support is so appreciated, and my hope is to continue to build the number of perks of being a paid member of my Patreon channel. There's a lot that I want to do over there. I'd also like to say thank you to the people who've signed up for free over on the Patreon channel as well. And if you're not already a member, free or paid, please head on over and check it out. Paid members receive early access to every single episode. There will soon be Patreon exclusive content that just isn't going to be on YouTube. And there is video content, even free. There are some of my episodes where I do like to layer over actual video clips, which has a, you know, really, really hard time getting through YouTube's copyright filters, even if that clip is covered under fair use, which I believe anytime I use it, it is covered under fair use. And Patreon makes that really, really easy. Whereas on YouTube, if I want to monetize that piece of content, I have to either accept that I can't monetize it, I can only partially monetize it, or I can layer over still images of the video, which just simply aren't as good. I had to do that for the Philadelphia Mob Hits episode 2, volume 2. On the Patreon channel, it's much better because I've got actual clips from the movie. Anyhow, enough of my pesky preambles. On to the episode, which I've entitled The State of the Mafia in 1967, The Rules That Bind Us Together, Part 1.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's set the stage here. This report, which I just referred to as a veritable goldmine of information, is from 1967 and was aimed at providing an overall picture of LCN membership and activities throughout the United States as things stood in around 1966 and 1967. The report itself was declassified in 1996. The originator of the report was a man named Robert G. O'Neill, not to be confused with former Navy SEAL Robert J. O'Neill, who is claimed to have fired the shot that killed Osama bin Laden. The report itself was submitted to the FBI director at the time, one J. Edgar Hoover. While, as I said, I did a Basics of the Mob series very early on in this podcast history, this report is simply something that I came across and found the information contained within so interesting that I decided it was worth an entire episode series. Frankly, I wasn't even sure. Honestly, I really wasn't even sure what to name the episode. I struggled with that part, which is why you got the mouthful of the name, which in the end I felt was fitting. Because the topics, quite frankly, that are discussed kind of bounce all over the place. So this is really an atypical piece of content that you're getting. Now, sometimes, as I said, in the course of historical research, you just find things that are simply too good not to share. In this case, I found this report by accident. I was researching the early Philadelphia history and Salvatore Sabella, Giuseppe Joe Trena. You'll see that early on in the research. And I got to reading this report, and I was, quite frankly, enthralled by it. And I think you will be, too. As I was pulling together this research, I kept hearkening back to some key scenes in the 1996 Gotti movie starring Armand Assante, in which they frequently refer to the rules.
How long have we been around this thing of ours? This Cosa Nostra. 120 years. I mean, what's it about? It's about the rules. Parameters.
The bottom line is John Gotti. Clipped. A soldier, my duchine, without my okay. That's a flagrant violation.
The rule was broken, yes. It calls for Gotti to die. Was the reason for breaking the rule so powerful that it was justified?
John, you cannot whack a made man on somebody else's crew. The rules. You break the rules, and this whole goddamn thing of ours cracks and crumbles. You never break the rules. A la famille. And the rules that hold us together.
A la familia. And the rules that hold us together.
The rules. This report, which I'll go through, lays out the state of LCN during what we know were some of the most turbulent times in the history of Cosa Nostra in the 1960s, but also, ironically, what I largely consider, especially as you get into the mid and late 60s after the heat from the Kennedys died down, I would consider this to be part of the golden era of the mob's influence on activity throughout the entire country. It's when they had a chokehold on every major city in the country. This report in its entirety, while I certainly won't read it all, it's hundreds of pages long, it will be linked on my website when the show goes live. It will also be linked in the description of the video on YouTube, as well as in the description of the podcast on the audio platforms. It contains references to 50 plus cities that had a mob presence and 196 unnamed informants just from the New York area alone. So shattering myths right away. The notion that Valachi was the only informant or the first informant. No, there were 196 birds singing in just New York alone. That's insane to me. I didn't know the number was that high. I knew there were more. But 196, there was not secrecy about this organization. It was an open secret. The point of this report, of course, was to facilitate sharing of information across all FBI field offices in an effort to educate and assist in coordination relating to investigating and ultimately bringing down the mafia at the time. And hindsight says, well, while the report certainly provided the field offices with a significant amount of information, much of which seemed to be on point, the FBI wasn't really largely successful in prosecuting the mafia, except for one-offs here and there, until the 1980s when RICO came into play, but still a good piece of information nonetheless. So let's go ahead and dig in. Okay, starting at the beginning, here was the high-level synopsis submitted by Agent Robert O'Neill, and as I said, it touches on a bit of everything. Quote, date, 10-20-67, title, La Cosa Nostra, character, anti-racketeering conspiracy, synopsis, information confirming existence of LCN and commission set forth. LCN known in different parts of U.S. as mafia, outfit, syndicate, or organization. Changes on commission brought about by death of Thomas Lucchese, 7-12-67, and uncertain status of Joseph Bonanno and Sam Giancana. Difference in initiation rites in various parts of U.S. set forth. Chicago and other areas have little initiation ceremonies, whereas some families have very solemn, involved rites. Procedures of trials for violations within the family set forth. Los Angeles family has charged head tax of members in past, and Gambino family members pay dues to capo regimas. LCN members arriving in another family's territory can be cleared to operate or obtain assistance within hours of arrival. Complete leadership and membership of LCN in U.S. set forth. U.S. family LCN members also live in Canada, Italy, and Mexico. Gambling continues to be widespread and principal source of LCN income. Grand juries, federal and local, continue to probe LCN activities. Magadino and Di Gregorio Bonanno families have interests in Canada and Haiti. LCN murders set forth, including information regarding LCN burial site in Jackson Township, New Jersey. LCN influence in Las Vegas hotels and casinos set forth, indicating that some LCN families have sold their interests in casinos. Howard Hughes, multi-millionaire industrialist, has purchased Desert Inn and Sands Hotel and casinos, but manner in which any alleged hidden interests were paid off is unknown. La Stella Restaurant Meeting, Queens, New York, 9-22-66, resulting in indictments against 7 participants, which were subsequently dismissed under appeal. AID, ostensibly formed to improve image of American Italians, was reportedly organized with backing of commission members Carlo Gambino and Joseph Colombo. End quote. Okay, I told you this report would cover a lot and kind of bounce all over the place. Anytime you see the word set forth, it essentially means that, well, they're going to cover something. So in the instance where it talked about murders set forth, well, they're going to cover murders. They're going to cover a particular thing. Now, we'll do our best to cover the majority in this series of what was mentioned in the synopsis, but we may split off some things for future episodes, as I said. In any event, I'll link to this report, like I said, in the episode's description, and feel free to peruse it yourself on your own time. It's fantastic. For the purposes of this episode series, here's what we're primarily going to cover. The existence, historical background, the commission, the organizational structure, terminology, qualifications and admission to membership, initiation rights, membership obligations. In the next series, we'll probably break off and begin covering the section on advantages of La Cosa Nostra membership, security, transfers of members, and then eventually we're going to get into criminal activities like bank robbery, gambling, LCN influence in Canada, Haiti, Mexico, in legitimate businesses, murder, narcotics, political corruption, the skimming, operations and hidden ownership of casinos in Las Vegas, as well as various other conspiratorial aspects, up to and including the Anti-Italian Anti-Defamation League Incorporated, which I referred to in the quote as AID, the Italian-American Civil Rights League, essentially. So a very wide range of topics. As I said, this show will have a little bit for everybody. Now, what makes this report unique is that much of the information is from confidential informants, and I know what you'll say, rats lie. However, while not everything I share can be taken as 100% fact, and in fact, I will poke holes in some of it or say where, hey, what this particular person said, while it may be generally true, there are instances that go against what this person said. My past research tends to tell me that much of the information, at minimum, is directionally accurate, if not specifically accurate. So you could be the judge as well. Send me your thoughts and your comments on some of the different aspects of the report. And I'd just love to interact with you guys. Okay, so first thing we're going to cover is A, the existence, historical background, existence, the role of the commission. So let's go ahead and dig into the information shared regarding the historical background relating to the existence of the mafia. Quote, one, existence, A, historical background. New York T-182 advised the mafia in Sicily with a small group of oppressed peasants whose plan was to destroy the control of large landowners and later grew into a criminally dominated group whose chief aim was financial betterment for themselves at any cost through any means. New York T-182 said the early activities of the mafia in the United States involved national and international control of prostitution, narcotics, smuggling operations, and any other illicit operation which would bring them fast money. New York T-182 advised that around 1920, the group began moving into legitimate fields and the use of the word mafia was used less because of the unfavorable publicity. New York T-182 stated that many of the old customs and laws of the mafia were dropped by the criminal organization in later years, but this organization had its origins in the old mafia. New York T-182 advised there is still the same blood relationship, the same loyalty, the same strict obedience, and the same penalties for those who become dangerous to the organization's objectives. New York T-182 explained that in practically every major city in the United States, there is a headman who is recognized as having complete control of the organization's activities in that particular area. The headman is the representative of the local group or organization in all activities, and the headman gains his position by proving himself capable of being the headman. New York T-182 indicated that to qualify as headman of the group, it was almost imperative that this person must at some time have committed a murder for the benefit of the group and in a way which the group approves. New York T-128 stated on infrequent occasions the position as headman is inherited from a brother or father, but only if the individual has been a direct part of the activities carried on by the former. End quote. Okay, so a few things. First, I think this summation probably skipped a few things for the sake of the report, or the person reporting simply didn't mention them. I think we know now that in addition to the enterprises mentioned, the most significant propellant of the organization's interests forward around 1920 or the late 19-teens was prohibition and the subsequent bootlegging activities that lasted into the early, almost mid-1930s. This, as I've said before, allowed the mobs in various cities to go from largely lower-class peasant criminals to flipping the established order of things and owning politicians due to the money that they were flush with, that they were then able to pay to get the politicians in their pockets, so to speak, much of which stemmed directly from bootlegging. It took peasants and made them rich and flipped the social order of things to where the peasants were now the people pulling the strings in control of the politicians, right? In addition, we also now know that the requirement that a person be a blood relative to get in was later dropped, in addition to the requirement of committing a murder. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit. At a certain point in time, there were many instances of men who may not have had a direct familial connection who were initiated, as well as men who had never committed a murder. That being said, with the murder aspect, I think that many of those in the life, especially guys like Michael Francis and Mikey Scars Di Leonardo, have stated that while they may have never personally killed someone, had they got the order to do so, and they may have been on hits but had not personally pulled the trigger, they may have been involved in murders but may not have personally pulled the trigger, if they were ever tasked by the boss to be their trigger puller, they had no problem doing it. They were ready and absolutely willing when they were in the life to carry out the boss's orders. It just never came to that, at least according to what they say or have hinted at. Moving forward in the report, here's a very interesting note relating to the Philadelphia family's very early history. And this is where I found the report. This is how it started. Quote, existence. On August 1st, 1966, New York T-86 advised that in 1920, Giuseppe Traina appointed Sam Sabella Salvatore, now deceased, as the first boss of the Philadelphia family. At this time, the organization was known as the Black Hand. Informant advised that he had been told that there were just a handful of original members in the organization in 1920. When John Avena took over the family in approximately 1930, it was known as the Mafia and was known as the Mafia up until the time that Angelo Bruno took over as boss. It was in Bruno's era of time that the organization was to be known as La Cosa Nostra, LCN, which the informant has translated to mean our thing. The informant said that he had been told that the first bosses were in sole command and they did not have capodachinas or underbosses. He had been told that capodachinas or underbosses came into use during the time that Joseph Bruno, 1936, was the boss of the Philadelphia family. End quote. Again, another interesting note. First, it goes to show that Giuseppe Traina, a.k.a. the peasant, a.k.a. Peppina, who was at that time the second in command to Salvatore Toto d'Aguila, and I apologize, I know in the one of the episodes I did early on, I pronounced that completely wrong, and I may even be pronouncing it wrong now, but it's d'Aguila, was an incredibly influential member, this being Giuseppe Traina, in the early days of the Mafia. He and d'Aguila were wielding a lot of power by sending a person to be the boss or the representante of a family in another city. That's a tremendous amount of power, especially at that time. Now, if you've ever watched the No Excuses podcast by RJ Roger and Mikey Scars for any length of time, you will have heard them speak of the impact of Traina and d'Aguila in those early days. This part of the report also shows a bit of the line of succession in the early days in Philadelphia, which I find really, really fascinating, from Sabella to Avena to Joe Bruno, who were the bosses prior to Joseph Ida and Angelo Bruno, no relation to Joseph Bruno. Now, in case you're interested, I highly, highly recommend listening to the series Jeff Canarsie is currently working on over on Mob Talk Radio, on the Philadelphia family history. It's really, in my opinion, I've been listening to him for a long time, some of his best work. I know Jeff has his haters, but trust me, the work that he has done, as well as the depth that he has put into his paid podcast, is really unparalleled, in my personal opinion, in terms of the broad scope of LCN and the history. And I highly recommend that you check it out if you haven't already. I know at this point, he's, you know, definitely beefing with the Merlino faction and people that love Joey Merlino. But if you care about the history, definitely give his paid podcast a chance. He's a paperwork guy just like myself. I've interviewed him, and I've got a lot of respect for his work. So go give him a look. Now, moving on, here's a note on the relative number of Maid members around 1967. Quote, existence. On July 18th, 1967, New York T25 advised that members of La Cosa Nostra, LCN, do not know how many actual members there are. Informants stated in conversation with many of them, they believe that there are probably between 3,000 and 3,500 members, and the most there could possibly be is about 4,000. Informants stated New York being headquarters probably has about 2,500, attributing 500 to each of the five families in New York. The remaining 1,000 would be scattered throughout the country. End quote. Now, this logic makes sense. While many members certainly probably know each other, Maid members have to be introduced, and this is something we'll talk about, have to be introduced to others via a third party who is also Maid, thus making it nearly impossible for an individual Maid man to know or be introduced to every single person in the organization. Even in their own family, it's probably, especially for big families like the ones in New York or even in Chicago, probably not every Maid man directly knows every other Maid man. While I'm sure people in the family, or even people that are associated with the family, and even outsiders like us, you hear rumors or are aware of certain people by reputation, the idea that nobody knows exactly how large the organization truly is or was at that time, based on those facts, tends to actually make sense. And in that respect, it was a secret organization. No one person should have the power to know everything. I'd even argue the bosses, probably even now today, may not know how big the organization is. They might know the number of Maid members within their own family, but that wouldn't necessarily mean that they would know all the members of other families as well across the country. But again, that's speculation. I'm a pure outsider. So that's just speculation for me and just thinking about it logically. Now, here's another interesting note that lends itself to how each family refers to itself. Quote, existence. New York T120, New York T96, New York T33, New York T73, and New York T145 have in the past furnished information that the outfit in Kansas City, Missouri, was synonymous with the LCN or the Mafia. These sources have previously pointed out that the leaders or members of the outfit have never used the terminology La Cosa Nostra or Mafia when discussing the activities of their organization. End quote. Now, prior to reading this, I knew families around the country had different ways of referring to themselves. However, what I didn't realize is that they didn't all necessarily refer to themselves as Cosa Nostra or La Cosa Nostra or our thing. I guess I just kind of always assumed that that came into fashion in 1931 with the restructuring after the Castellamarese War ended. However, it seems like that was a bit of a myth, a bit of a fallacy. So maybe the words that we know them by, they don't actually use themselves. And I do think we'll see that going on throughout this episode. And now we get into what the FBI believed to be the structure of the commission in 1967, just after Tommy Lucchese's passing. Quote, existence. B, the commission. During the period of this investigation and in the past, numerous informants have advised that the ruling body and ultimate authority of La Cosa Nostra, LCN, is the commission. The commission consists of the following individuals. Vito Genovese, incarcerated, New York, New York. Carlo Gambino, New York, New York. Joseph Colombo, New York, New York. Stefano Magadino, Buffalo, New York. Joseph Cirilli, Detroit, Michigan. Angelo Bruno, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Thomas Lucchese of New York, New York, died on July 12, 1967 of a brain tumor. His replacement as head of that family has not been verified by investigation to date, as set out in the leadership section of this report. no information has been received to indicate that Lucchese's position on the commission has been filled. Joseph Bonanno of New York and Tucson, Arizona, has been reported by various sources as attempting to retake his old position as boss of his family and may have succeeded. As reported previously, Bonanno was reportedly deposed from his position on the commission, as well as being demoted within or expelled from his family. There is no indication that Bonanno, although he may have taken over his family again, has been placed back on the commission. Sam Giancana of Chicago, Illinois, was a member of the commission for years. However, due to his incarceration from June 1, 1965 to May 31, 1966, and his subsequent flight to Mexico in 1966, leadership of the Chicago family has not definitely been resolved. It appears very likely that Anthony Joseph Accardo and Paul DiLucia, also known as AKA Paul Rica, jointly direct the Chicago family, with Rica believed to be the commission representative. The following individuals are considered to control the LCN families or groups in their respective territories and ultimately answer to the commission either directly or through representatives for their areas of the country. They are Raymond L.S. Patriarca, New England; Samuel Rizzo Di Cavalcante, New Jersey; Santo Traficante Jr., Florida; John LaRocca, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania; Russell A. Buffalino, upstate Pennsylvania; John T. Scalish, Cleveland, Ohio; Nicholas Savella, Kansas City, Missouri; Anthony Giordano, St. Louis, Missouri; Carlos Marcello, New Orleans, Louisiana; Joseph Savello, Dallas, Texas; Frank Balestrieri, Milwaukee, Wisconsin; James Coletti, Colorado; Nick Licata, Los Angeles, California; Joseph Cerrito, San Jose, California; James Joseph Lanza, San Francisco, California. It is noted that Russell A. Buffalino has been described as a Capodichino in the Lucchese family, but there are indications that the upstate Pennsylvania group controlled by him may be a distinct LCN family. A similar situation exists in Dallas, Texas, where that group is considered to possibly be a part of the Vito Genovese family. End quote. Now, again, the level of what the FBI knew at the time, much of which appeared to be spot on, seemed incredible, despite their inability to really prosecute many of the bosses successfully. Probably the biggest thing that they were somewhat wrong on was the assertion that Buffalino was a Lucchese member, although they correctly pointed out that he did head his own family. That being said, Buffalino was so close to almost everyone in New York and was there so frequently that it's probably just a simple mistake, especially because they were really piecing this information together without the benefit of the hindsight that we now have. We now know that there was a Buffalino family. They were seeing this for the first time and trying to piece all the information together. And quite frankly, they were doing a pretty damn good job, in my opinion, based on the stuff that we're seeing in this report. And that's because they had 100, almost 200 informants giving them information. Additionally, I think it's now pretty well known that the group in Dallas was indeed a family. It was a distinctive family, but connected heavily to the New Orleans family, not the Genovese family. That being said, though, most of these families had cross-country connections, so it wouldn't surprise me if the Dallas family somehow had ties to the Genovese family in New York. Again, something to explore possibly for a future episode. I know, you know, of the connection, for example, between San Jose and the Profaci's back in New York, and San Jose and the Detroit family back in New York. A lot of these connections with these guys goes cross country in any family. And now, here's what I'll say. Get ready for the tinfoil hat section of this episode, although I think you'll agree that the premise of what I'm about to tell you is absolutely believable. This could be its own episode in and of itself. Now, here's a bit regarding the conspiracy to assassinate Albert Anastasia and the potential involvement of a player you might not expect, but that would make sense once you hear it. Quote, the commission. on July 28, 1967, New York T7 advised that in the autumn of 1957, Vito Genovese had engineered the killing of Albert Anastasia because he was becoming too powerful and presented a challenge to Genovese's authority and his goal. It had always been Genovese's objective to abolish the commission and return the control of La Cosa Nostra, LCN, to a capo di capi, boss of bosses. Genovese has always wanted to be capo di capi and had selected Joe Bonanno as his number one man. Bonanno had been part of the conspiracy inasmuch as the arrangement between them was that Bonanno would succeed Genovese upon Genovese's death or retirement. He said that Genovese and Bonanno have for many years conspired towards the objective of first uniting all five New York families and thereafter control the other LCN families throughout the United States. On August 18, 1967, New York T-123 furnished similar information regarding Bonanno's plans. However, he differed from New York T-7 by stating that this was Bonanno's plan and Genovese was not included. According to New York T-123, when the other family heads learned of this, Bonanno was advised to cease such plans, and alternate being to give up his family and position. Bonanno then went to Arizona and ran his family from that area and continued to conspire against his former associates. End quote. Wow. That's a bit of a bombshell to just drop right in the middle of this episode. The plot really thickens. I think most believe now that the plot to assassinate Albert Anastasia was hatched certainly by Genovese, but also in collaboration with one Carlo Gambino, who would eventually, of course, take over and become the namesake of what was the Mangano Anastasia family previously. However, this angle with Bonanno would seem to make Gambino simply a benefactor, but would ultimately set up Bonanno down the line. At least that's if you believe it. And if you play it out, then shortly after the Apalachin meeting is busted, many suspect Bonanno as being the one to drop the dime on the meeting. And a few years later, Genovese is framed and goes away to prison. I believe that happened in 1959. Now, if you believe the Bonanno angle here, that is the move that should have put Bonanno in the number one position in New York, except that he and Gambino were not allies. And as we know, they would go at each other in the early 1960s, with Gambino ultimately winning out and Bonanno essentially tucking tail and heading to Arizona in a state of semi-retirement, though it's pretty clear that he would meddle for many, many years from Arizona. Now, I don't know if I truly believe this theory, but you have to admit that if you put on your tinfoil hat, it is certainly plausible that Bonanno, the snake, the old snake, very Machiavellian, very smart and shrewd, this could have been a possibility. This absolutely could have been. Let me know what you think in the comments below. It was certainly very interesting. Now, going back to the Midwest, here's some reports on how the commission was communicating with the Chicago outfit and disseminating orders to the west of Chicago. Quote, the commission, on January 26, 1967, New York T-155 explained that the commission has designated the boss of the Chicago family as the one responsible for transmitting important information, also decisions, new changes, or important orders to all members living west of Chicago. The informant advised that John Roselli, who lives in Los Angeles, is a member of the Chicago family and is the person who transmits this information to the families living in the West Coast area. The information must be given verbally and is never put in writing or through a second party. Information of this importance would be given verbally by the Chicago boss to Roselli, who would then furnish it verbally in a face-to-face meeting with bosses of the families in the West, and they in turn would notify their members. The informant stated the fact that all important La Cosa Nostra business is carried from one family to another by word of mouth. End quote. Now, this certainly shows the interesting flow of communication of orders and the level of secrecy coming from the commission out across the country. And it does go to show how important Chicago and specifically Johnny, Handsome Johnny Roselli were. This also lays the groundwork for one of the reasons Roselli was ultimately later murdered. He simply knew too much. I mean, he was involved in a lot of high-level things. However, I think we've seen, and this is where I'm going to push back a little bit. Again, I'm an outsider, but I do think we've seen evidence that this communication style, while maybe used in most cases, was not employed in all cases. For example, Stefano Magadino was reputed, and he was a member of the commission for as long as he was alive, was reputed to have personally relayed commission orders to Joe Cerrito to sue Life magazine in the late 1960s as a test case against media outlets. And that communication happened, it's documented, it happened via a payphone and not face-to-face. And speaking of California, there was a note, a very interesting note, regarding the Los Angeles family's involvement in communicating commission orders as well. Quote, the commission, New York T 77 and New York T 78 have advised that the Los Angeles LCN Brugade reports to and is in contact with the commission through the brigade of Thomas Lucchese, deceased of New York, as no member of the Los Angeles brigade is on the commission. New York T-77 and New York T-78 have also advised that prior to his death on August 4th, 1967, Los Angeles LCN boss Frank DeSimone represented smaller Western brigades before the commission at such times that an LCN representative from the Western United States was necessary. After such meetings, it was the responsibility of DeSimone to relay the instructions of the commission to the bosses of other Western LCN brigades. These sources have also advised that DeSimone did not necessarily meet with full commission, but rather he met out east with two or three men who relayed commission instructions to him. End quote. Interesting. Now, I will just clarify, brigade is synonymous with family, right? So if you hear the word brigade, that's B-R-U-G-A-D, that means family. This report, to some degree, conflicts with the previous note related to Chicago disseminating all commission orders, right? And aligns to the idea that while Chicago may have had major influence, there were still connections from west to east where commission orders could be relayed without necessarily using Chicago as the only go-between for commission orders. Now, my best guess is that both happened. Chicago was certainly important. I'm not trying to downplay that, and certainly communicated orders out west, but the Western and Midwestern families also had their own relationships and in many cases communicated directly with each other as well. There's plenty of evidence to support that. Okay, let's push ahead and talk through some of the report's information documenting the organizational structure and terminology. Apologies again if some of this isn't new information, but I do still find it fascinating, and I hope you do as well. We're going to get deep into structure, terminology, and especially initiation rites. Quote, two, organizational structure. A, terminology. At various times during the period of this report, New York T-77, New York T-122, and New York T-76, together with other informants, have advised that the LCN is nationwide and broken down into groups throughout the United States. These sources have advised that the LCN is nationwide and is broken down into groups throughout the United States known as families or brigades. These groups are located primarily in major cities of the eastern, midwestern, and western parts of the United States. There are LCN families located in Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Massachusetts, for example, as well as five families located in New York City. Information received from New York T-77, New York T-122, and New York T-76 reflects that the LCN organization continues to function in conformance with the following chain of command. Commission. The commission is the highest body in LCN. The membership is composed for the most part of the most powerful bosses of the individual brigades. The number of the commission can vary, although at least in the past, New York T-77 recalled that it had been composed of 5 to 8 members. The commission is the ultimate and final authority in this organization. Brigade. A brigade is also known as a family. The brigade is autonomous and operates with complete jurisdiction in the area assigned to it. There is to be no interference by any other family. It is subject only to the authority and control of the commission. The size, strength, and membership of the families vary. Boss or Il Capo. This individual is in charge of the brigade. His authority is absolute and he is the final arbiter in all matters relating to the affairs of the brigade. Underboss. This individual is the lieutenant of the boss. He generally relays instructions from the boss and acts as the boss in the absence of the boss. Consigliere. In each brigade, there is a position known as consigliere. This position is not in the direct line of command. The consigliere is to arbitrate disputes between members and serve as an advisor. Capo regime or capo regime. In each brigade, there are various capo regimes. This is the operational level of the organization. The men in the brigade are assigned to various capo regimes and are obligated to carry out their orders. There is apparently no set or fixed number of capos in a brigade, nor are there presently fixed numbers of men assigned to a capo. Soldier. The individual members of a brigade are known as soldiers. Soldiers are assigned to capos. End quote. Okay, so I don't think any of that information is necessarily new, so bear with me as we do get into some pretty juicy tidbits regarding the qualifications and admission to membership. I think some myths are about to be put to bed, and some of the following information I think you'll find pretty fascinating. Quote, B, qualifications and admission to membership. On January 11th, 1967, New York T-121 advised that LCN in the United States is drawn together very closely for security as a result of organized crime investigations. No new members are being brought in. No transfers from one family to another in the United States is allowed. No transfers under any conditions from Italy to the United States for the past 10 years. He stated that because of being able to apply pressure on families in Italy, the Italian government was successful in sending 2 LCN members from Sicily to the United States for informant purposes, but they were made by the outfit before their ship docked in New York. As a result of this, no transfers are allowed in Italy to the United States. Las Vegas is an open city with several families participating in gambling and other activities in that area. In the past, when new members were made, they had to be sponsored by a tried-and-true, tough member of the outfit after serving several years as an apprentice closely watched by the sponsor. He stated that the outfit was more concerned about the sponsor's okay than any other element for membership. He indicated that a member had to have the stuff to qualify, but informant did not spell out qualification details at this time. Informant stated members never refer to their organization as Mafia or La Cosa Nostra. He stated the outfit is very reluctant to admit burglars and rarely, if ever, allows a longtime professional pimp to be a member because it is considered a basic weakness of character. End quote. Now, there are several things about that particular report, that bit of the report, that I find fascinating. First, the moratorium on transfers from Italy. While this might have been in place as a security measure at the time, I think it's clear that eventually that ban was lifted as Zips began to be brought in, at minimum by Carmine Galante and the Bananos, as of the mid to late 1970s. And I think it's pretty well known that as you got into the 1990s and even today, especially when Frank Cali was still alive, the Sicilian faction of the Gambino family grew and became very powerful again. As for the information regarding Las Vegas as an open city and a proposed member needing to be approved by a trusted sponsor, that's certainly not new information. Now, the information about not initiating burglars or pimps, I find really curious when you consider that even the likes of Charles Lucky Luciano and elements of his family, like little Davy Patillo, essentially ran all the prostitution houses in the city for which they were convicted in 1936. And that set in place the chain of events that led to a lot of the problems in the 50s, 60s, and beyond. And even if you don't believe that Lucky was directly involved, you can't really argue there. I've read a lot about that case. There was a lot of evidence to suggest that they were running the houses of ill repute. They had their hand definitely in it, so to speak, and they were taking money from it. So that doesn't directly make you a pimp, but it makes you the controller of the pimps. And then people like Tony Spilotro, who made a career out of burglary, were clearly initiated and even considered, especially at this time, up-and-comers. That opinion from the information just doesn't jive with the facts. There definitely were burglars in Cosa Nostra, people that broke into houses to make scores of all kinds. And although the facts I'm referring to very well might be just edge cases and they generally didn't want to admit pimps or burglars, maybe, maybe the policy was just more broad. And again, I just might be referring to edge cases in examples out on the fringes, despite the larger general policy. So that just may be what I'm doing here. Now, here are some interesting reports in the differences in making ceremonies in various cities. You're going to find this interesting. Quote, qualifications and admission to membership. Sources who are members of the Chicago family of LCN have advised that there are no initiation ceremonies or rites attendant to initiation into this family. It was the consensus among these sources that there is no formal initiation and that an individual who is being considered for membership on the basis of his past performance has a sponsor who has tested him in many different ways with various assignments, on occasions, killings. If the sponsor deems the individual of such caliber as to warrant membership, the sponsor will advise the candidate that he should contact a particular person and name that individual. At the time of contact, the candidate is to advise the person he contacts that his sponsor sent him to you. Accordingly, the top persons, all of whom would be aware of the candidate's background, would look him over, question him, and may even give him an assignment themselves as a further test. After reaching their decision concerning the candidate, if he is accepted for membership, his sponsor is advised, and the sponsor, in turn, advises the candidate that he is in or made. Once he is accepted as a member, he cannot get out. These informants indicated that there are those persons who are members but who are inactive or retired. However, if they are called upon by the outfit to perform some service, they are bound to do so regardless of whether they are active or inactive. End quote. Now, I have heard that Chicago and some other families didn't fully embrace the traditional idea of the making ceremony, but I'd never actually seen a report, and maybe this is just for lack of looking, but I've never seen a report personally that confirmed this fact until now. I'm sure other historians have come across this before, so this is just new to me. In fact, if you read the book, and this is a different family, not Chicago, but if you read the book, The Life We Chose, it's a new book by Matt Birkbeck about the life and times of Big Billy D'Elia, he told a similar story about his making ceremony into the Buffalino family. Now, I won't spoil it. You'll just have to go out and buy the book. It's available on Amazon. I've read it cover to cover. Very great book, especially if you're interested to hear stories about Russell Buffalino. Billy tells a lot of things. Next, we'll get a little deeper into those initiation rites and rituals, which should at this point be a little more familiar to hardcore mob fans. This report is going to get into what I think you would have heard of. Quote, C, initiation rites. On January 26th, 1967, New York T 154 advised that he, redacted, at the time of the initiation, all of the members redacted family were present. He stated that in those days, the rule was that all members had to be present at the initiation of a new member. They sat around the table, and the informant sat next to his sponsor. The sponsor cut the informant's finger with a knife to let the blood flow freely, and the significance was that the outfit was more important than his life. After this, his sponsor placed into the informant's cupped hands a picture of a saint, such as the type used as bookmarks in prayer books, and set it on fire. The informant had to hold this until it burned to ashes. The significance of this action was that the outfit must take precedence over God. The informant explained this outfit was to be held above all things, material or spiritual. One of the leaders in the family then administered some type of general oath to the effect he would uphold the family. After this initiation was completed and the oath given, he did some kind of a little dance around the table, during which each member of the family took turns embracing him and welcoming him. The informant stated that later, the burning of a saint's picture was changed to burning a piece of paper with a saint's name written on it, and as the outfit grew, all members of the family were not present at the initiation. End quote. And again, a lot of what I described above was pretty standard protocol for many families across the country, although I think we know there were still differences between families. And of course, as times have gone on, ceremonies have likely changed even more significantly and maybe now have less of the old world gravitas, if that makes sense, and more security measures, simplicity just to get the deed done and avoid, you know, surveillance, scrutiny, wires, so on and so forth. I've even heard of ceremonies actually taking place in men's bathrooms, which would probably make some old timers turn in their graves. It just not the same in terms of the pomp and circumstance. I also find it amusing to imagine all members being present at an initiation as the thought of potentially hundreds of people present and cramming together into a room in secret, probably even in the old days, wasn't that easy to secure. Kind of sounds like a bit of a clown car, if you can imagine them all piling in and piling out of that room. But it sounds like they ultimately made the wise choice and reduced the number of people that had to be present for an initiation. And this having everybody present was likely more of a function of the families being starting smaller in the old days than they were as you got into the 50s, 60s, 70s, so on and so forth, especially in New York, where you have the really significantly large families. I've heard it change to just capos and bosses present, along with the prospects who were being inducted. And in some cases, not even all of the capos, just the important and pertinent ones for that particular making ceremony. Now, at a future session with the FBI, New York T-154 would get into even more detail about the initiation rites, saying the following, quote, on February 15th, 1967, New York T-154 continued his description of initiation procedure. He stated that when the members gather for a meeting, they are all in one room with all doors locked. They usually sit around a table with the boss of the family at the head of the table. At his right is the consigliere. On his other side is the underboss. The boss then gives the word and all members join hands. The boss then says in Sicilian, "For our cause, the family is united." They then release their hands, although they are still united in their minds. The new members to be initiated stand outside the circle. They are then brought forward for initiation. At a given sign from the boss, the new member will be sponsored for membership by his godfather. At this point, the boss will ask if there are any objections. Any old member can ask if the new member has proven himself. The godfather or sponsor for the new member must simply tell those present that the new member has proven himself. There are no objections usually because the new member's activities in proving himself are already well established and known. To prove himself, the informant indicated that the new member had to perform for the family in a family matter. The interviewing agents both received the strong impression that the informant meant by proving oneself that the new member had committed a killing or participated in a killing to qualify for membership. When it was pointed out to the informant the apparent weakness in character observed in some of the older members known to interviewing agents, the informant agreed but stated that at some point in their early life, they had to prove themselves for membership and again indicated that at this point they had to either kill or participate in a killing for the family. After the new members are brought into the circle, the godfather or the sponsor for each new member will prick the end of the new member's finger until the blood flows, and then place in the new member's cupped hands the picture of a saint, or later a piece of paper with the saint's name written on it, and set it afire. He must hold this burning paper until it becomes ashes. Again, he stressed the significance of this to mean the flowing of the blood and the burning of the saint meant the LCN family, which he was joining, was to take precedence over his own life and God. The informant advised that after this, the boss informed the new members that they were in the organization for life and that they must answer any demand of the family without hesitation or questioning. Returning to his description of the initiation, he advised that after the above-described procedure and the description of the duties of a new member, the old members of the family joined hands again in a circle. On a given word from the boss, they release their hands, and the boss says in Italian something to the effect that the chain is broken. Then, on command from the boss, they all rejoin hands, including the new members, and the boss again says in Sicilian words to the effect that the chain has been reestablished. This completes the initiation rites of the new members. The informant advised that the whole procedure is very formal and the members speak only when the boss permits them to speak. At no time can anyone leave the room. End quote. Now, as Phil Leotardo might say,
they make anybody and everybody over there. And the way that they do it, it's all fucked up. Guys don't get their finger pricked. There's no sword and gun on the table.
Phil.
No, Al. Either it has meaning or no meaning.
I did find it curious that there wasn't a description of the sword, knife, or gun being present on the table. That doesn't mean it wasn't there, right? But it is very possible that that's more of a Hollywood thing or just simply was either not mentioned or not recorded by the agents. Another informant would describe their own initiation and would provide more detail on the duties and expectations of behavior once he was made. And again, this is the 1960s. It's shocking to me how many made guys were describing their making at this point in time in the golden era. Quote, initiation rites. On June 9th, 1966, New York T-127 advised, redacted again, asked whether there were any objections to informant's membership, and when none were voiced, he was straightened out, a term used by informant and accepted within redacted LCN families, signifying being made. He said his initiation contained nothing more than a talk by his capo at which other members of his group were present and during which he was told something to the effect, "You are with us. Act like a man. Comport yourself as a man and be a man. Do nothing before you check with us and be sure to get the okay before you do anything. That if you have a disagreement with another individual who is made, do not try to settle it yourself, but come to us and we will reach the right settlement. That if you make a good score, tell us, and if it is big enough, share it. That if you leave town or are away, leave a number where you can be reached. And lastly, do whatever we tell you." Informant stated there was no ritual, such as burning a holy picture, cutting fingers, or mixing blood, and that this redacted, end quote. Too bad that report was redacted, as I'd have liked to see, you know, some of the information that was covered up, but I think you got the gist of it. However, I do find it interesting, as given that these New York-based informants, as their symbol code indicated, this would suggest that different families, even within New York, may have had different initiation procedures, with some ranging from very formal to others being far more relaxed. And I do find it all fascinating, and I do think what we're hearing is a discrepancy between newer members at that time versus older members, and the procedures being different at different points in time and different between different families. I think we're getting that a little bit. Alas, we press on, and I know I'm probably beating a dead horse at this point, but we have yet a different informant who appears to have been made discussing their initiation and some of the rules as they were explained regarding proper procedures for meeting made members. They would say the following. Quote, initiation rites. On July 31st, 1967, New York T-161 furnished the following information regarding his initiation into LCN and of his knowledge of certain LCN activities. Redacted. Informant advised that after being introduced to those present, all arose to their feet, crossed their arms, and formed a circle. He was thereafter administered an oath in Sicilian and was asked that informant swear that he placed nothing before his family, that his personal family came next, that he swore to uphold the honor of the group and would swear to do all that was asked of him. Informant explained that the above were the highlights that he could recall of this oath, and possibly there were other ramifications of lesser importance. Informant said that the individual pricked his middle finger with a needle, and while informant bled, he gave some type of intonation or cant, which was given in rapid Sicilian and which could only be summed up by informant as mumble jumble. Informant explained that he is of Sicilian heritage, but that he could not understand half of what was said, except it seemed like a repetition of vows he had previously taken concerning his allegiance to the group. Informant advised that after this initiation, he was giving his schooling, which he recalled consisted in part of the manner in which he was to address people of various rank within the family, that he observed the rule that he not advertise the fact that he was now a member of LCN. At this point, informant explained, this is the most commonly violated rule since most members were so elated at their being made that they would not hesitate to let the world know it. Informant also recalled that he was instructed on how to meet people and was advised that in the event he were to introduce another soldier who was unknown to a third party that was known by informant as a member, he would say, A meet B, he's a friend of ours. Pause, B meet A, he's a friend of ours. Informant explained that the proper method of introduction was to repeat this phrase, which would be interpreted as meaning accord this person respect. He's a member, even though he's from a different family, he's one of us. Informant also recalled that he was instructed that in any dispute which arose between him and a member of his own family or of any other family should not be settled with violence, but that before this point were reached, he should immediately notify his capi, a term repeatedly used by informant signifying capo regime. Informant stated he was also instructed that it was mandatory that he attend funerals of the members of his family as well as their close relatives. Redacted. Informant said weddings were not mandatory except if a member received an invitation from another member or if they were instructed to attend by their capi. Informant explained in this connection that he was also advised that in the event he had close and reliable friends in the rackets who might one day be considered for membership in LCN, he should register this person with his capi and also let it generally be known throughout the neighborhood that he was so allied with him. Informant said that this served the purpose of keeping other members from moving in on him, and also this person might later be considered for membership. End quote. Again, very interesting stuff. So the next time you watch Donnie Brasco and see the friend of ours or friend of mine scene, you'll know it's not BS.
Okay, when I introduce you, I'm going to say, this is a friend of mine. That means you're a connected guy. Now, if I said instead, this is a friend of ours, that would mean you were a made guy. A capiche?
And if you listen to many of the former mobsters who are now on YouTube, you will have probably heard this before, but I've never actually seen it in a report, so pretty cool. Additionally, the part about staking a claim to new prospects as a way to build your own crew and keep others from encroaching is actually a very savvy move, in my opinion. I'd always thought the claim was solely based on the candidate's ability to make money, and while that may be a big part of why some associates are fought over, Donnie Brasco, for example, using a claim as a defensive strategy was definitely something that I had not considered. Hopefully this is all of interest to you because I personally ate it up when I was reading the report for the first time. I know that I've said that a few times. Here are a few last instances of made men turned informants describing their initiation ceremonies. Quote, initiation rites. New York T96 has advised that Redacted at the time of his initiation was approximately as follows. Honor is stressed as the most sacred thing in the world. To destroy another person must be for honor and not money alone. A member is warned never to engage in an affair with the wives of other members. A member must never engage in white slavery or narcotics, both crimes which are degrading to the name of the organization. A member must obey the complaints and instructions of his superior and is never to take the life of a fellow member before presenting his grievance to the commission. A member must do nothing which would affect the organization without first receiving permission from a superior. The sponsor or godfather would take a knife or pin, redacted, and draw blood from the candidate by pricking one of his fingers. The blood was smeared on a holy card, which was then set aflame and placed in the cupped hands of the candidate. While the card burned, the sponsor would affirm that the candidate would uphold the code of the organization and that if he should fail in this regard, his body would be destroyed as symbolized by the burning of the card. Following this ceremony, all members always embraced the new member and kissed him on both cheeks. New York T-171 was shown the description of the initiation ceremony for La Cosa Nostra and expressed some opinions about it. He indicated that the stress upon the word honor is quite accurate and certainly reveals a great deal about our group. For example, he pointed out the prohibition against killing of one member by another for financial motives alone should also show similar prohibition of such an act merely to attain power. He said that while one member may kill another immediately upon having his honor affronted or in self-defense, he is not allowed to do so at a later time when he should have called off without having first secured permission from his superiors. This informant advised that another thing which should be added to the induction ceremony is the prohibition of any device, especially a bomb which could cause injury or death to anyone except the member to be hit. He said that any grievance serious enough to warrant the killing of one member by another is a personal thing, but that this can never justify the injury or death of children, wives, or bystanders. He pointed out that this slovenly method of hitting someone is probably best illustrated by the incidents which have occurred in Youngstown, Ohio area in recent years. He said that the use of bombs for a hit at Youngstown during which other innocent people were killed so infuriated us that it has been necessary to get rid of a lot of young guys. He said that not only are members prohibited from engaging in narcotics traffic and in white slavery, but they are prohibited from participation in any phase of counterfeiting. He could not say that the holding of a burning holy card is never used in any induction ceremony, but that he personally never got no burns on my hands that way. He did, however, have his finger pricked. End quote. The last report I'll share on making ceremonies said the following. Quote, initiation rites. New York T-179 advised on September 14, 1967, that he was initiated into the LCN, redacted. There was no candlelight ceremony during this initiation, nor was there mixing of blood, nor oaths given with religious pictures. He states that this ceremony, as described with oaths, etc., went out approximately 25 years ago. At the time of the informant's initiation, it was not a prerequisite for a member to have participated in a hit, although this was the case for the older members prior to 25 years ago. Informant states that the books for the new members are closed and have been for some time, at least insofar as his particular family is concerned. There were other family present during the initiation banquet, and following the banquet for the next several weeks, informant was taken around to LCN members and introduced as a new member. This latter situation is that which the informant described during the previous contacts and states that this is what he construed as formal initiation when he was taken around. New York T-176 advised that usually when an individual is a made guy, somebody will inform the group that he is a made guy. Informant explained that when this word is passed around, everybody would then be careful of how they talk to this made guy and also would not cross this made guy. Informant further explained that usually this word spreads around the street very fast. Okay, a ton to unpack in both of those reports. And again, I should say about all of the reports, especially the ones that tend to indicate that people were made in the 60s when the books were supposedly closed, that just breaks the myth that the books were closed and that no new members were made in the 60s. That's just not true. New members were made possibly as replacements for members who had passed away, not necessarily to grow the size of the family. But the fact of the matter is people were getting made in families all across the country, even in the 60s when the books were supposedly closed. I found a lot of evidence of that. And again, some of this stuff is known, like the rules against never sleeping with another member's wife, the ban on narcotics, though clearly many still did it, and the need to go to superiors prior to major decisions like killing, unless it's done in self-defense.
Frankie, the little guy, he wouldn't be fucking the Jew's wife, would he? Because if he is, it's a problem.
It is interesting to see the differences in the various ceremonies, and this last report leads me to believe, like I said before, that many of the previous reports could have possibly been made by older members who had experienced an initiation ceremony with more formality, which seems to have gone by the wayside by this point in the 1960s, at least within some families. However, the prohibition on bombs I found interesting and curious. I think if you follow this genre, you will have heard that the mob in America really tried to stay away from the use of car bombs. And we know car bombs were used more prominently in Sicily. But there are so many instances that prove this rule was simply just a fallacy. It's not accurate. For example, the Youngstown incident, which I can believe upset a lot of people, is referring to the killing of mobster Charles Cadillac Charlie Cavallaro and his 11-year-old son Tommy on November 3rd, 1962, via a car bomb. His other son, who is actually still alive and more recently shared his story really for the first time, was injured when the bomb went off as he was just feet from the car. It was said that between 1953 and 1963, there were 80 bombings in Youngstown alone as the Pittsburgh and Cleveland families vied for control of the area. In addition to this, you do have the use of bombs prominently in the Spiro-Civella War in Kansas City that killed all of the Spiro brothers who were rivals of the Civella family, and we did talk about this in the interview with Gary Jenkins. Then there was clearly the bombing of Danny Green and Shonder Burns in Cleveland in the 1970s, and I know both of those guys were associates, but you can argue that those bombings were driven, especially the one on Danny Green, to some degree by mob-related activities, and specifically the killing of Danny Green was driven by the Italian mob, right? And of course, Shonder Burns was killed by Danny Green, so that was a little different, but still, bombs were used. A bomb killed Gambino underboss Frankie DiCicco in the 1980s. Bombs were used all over the place in Milwaukee in the Balestrieri era, so much so that he got the nickname the Mad Bomber. There was also the bombing of Frank Lefty Rosenthal's car in Las Vegas in, I believe, the late 1970s. So, need I go on? In any event, I think the no-bomb rule was well-intentioned, but when push came to shove, the mob did in fact use that method of killing many times over, and in many cases it was clearly sanctioned by very important figures within LCN. And I think that's it for this episode. This is where we're going to make the break point, and we will come back with episode 2 at some point in the very near future. Okay, so that's the end of another episode. If you liked it, please do me a favor and share the episode, give it a thumbs up, subscribe, hit the bell to turn on notifications. I encourage you to hop on board and check out my Patreon channel. A lot of good reasons to go over there and join, even if you just join for free. In any event, please leave your comments below and tell me what you liked and disliked about this particular episode. And if you want to reach out to me personally, you can do so by sending an email to ganglandhistorypodcast@gmail.com. I appreciate all of you and look forward to continuing to produce new content. Thank you for helping me get over the 10,000 subscriber threshold on YouTube. Really appreciated it. This episode series, as I said, will be continued, and there's a lot more from that report to get into. It's pure gold again, although I may intersperse additional episodes in between as I am now starting to get paperwork back. I do have the intention of doing quick scene reviews, specifically from The Godfather, but then I want to branch into other movies and do full movie reviews and sort of continuing that in the near future. And those will be added to Patreon only, again, because that's just something that has a hard time getting through the YouTube copyright filters. Additionally, I'm also digging into and beginning to set up more interviews. I would like to continue to do those. That's not something I've been super strong at or have done a lot of, but I do want to begin to talk to people other than myself. And I will begin to reach out to prospective guests pretty soon. And again, I've got a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests in the works. I'm going to be getting back to biographies. Biographies tend to be some of my best and most viewed episodes, and I haven't done those nearly enough, so that is something that I want to get back to. There is something to be said for that beginning-to-end style of format. In any event, as I said, thank you for your continued support, and as I end every episode, grazie.
Thank you for listening to the Gangland History Podcast. If you'd like to donate to the show, check out our Patreon channel. If you're watching on YouTube, please hit like and subscribe to help the channel grow. If you're an audio-only listener, subscribe via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Until next time, don't forget to keep your mouth shut.